House will come to order. Flag salute will be led by all stand, please. Thank you. If able, the flag salute will be led by Representative Garrett.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Opening ceremony will be presented by... Would you like to stand? We'll remain standing. Opening ceremony will be presented by Martin L. Webb from Clackamas, the guest of Representative Barton.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we bow our heads before Thee to give our gratitude unto Thee for our liberties and our freedoms, our agency. And Father, we're grateful for this great nation. We're grateful for the representatives of this nation and for this great state of Oregon. Father, we pray that Thou will bless them, that they might be steadfast and immovable in their pursuit for righteousness in their decisions, that they might be able to make decisions for this great state that can bless the lives of those of this state of Oregon. Father, we pray that Thou will help us to always sacrifice the self-natural man within us, that we might be able to bring ourselves to the lower levels of meekness, that we might be acceptable for the light of Christ to guide us and influence our lives. Father, we pray that Thou will always keep our hearts open as we are stewards of our hearts, that we can be able to receive the Holy Ghost and being able to help us in our decisions. Father, we pray that Thou will help us as we go forth in our lives, that we can be an influence for good. And these things we humbly pray for and ask for in the name of Thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you very much. Courtesies. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and colleagues, please join me in welcoming our invocator this morning, Martin Webb, who's standing on the side right there. Martin is an elder in the LDS Church and very much a leader in my community. I first met him, actually, while going door-to-door. And his special task, or shall we say, that he currently serves in is working with young adults. And unsurprisingly, we became fast friends. It's really a pleasure. He's always become a good friend. Also, being that I of course, am a bachelor and don't cook very well, he and his family are so kind as to frequently have me over for dinner, and I rarely eat so well. So thank you very much for coming down here and for your continued friendship.
Further courtesies, Representative Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I am very pleased and proud today to have two special guests here with me, my grandsons, Joel and Samir Yassin. Joel sitting at my desk, and Representative Matthews has been very kind and let Samir sit at his desk. They are actually constituents of Representative Matthews, and they're here today to get a tour of the Capitol and a little flavor of what we do. They're going to get to see the Gold Man later on. So, and their mom is up in the gallery with their foster sister, Beth and Destiny. So,
welcome to your Capitol. It's great to have you here today. Yeah. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'm now starting on my next House District for honorary pages. I would like to introduce to you, KJ, would you please stand? Thank you. This is KJ Thatcher. He's not mine as far as my son or my constituent, but he does go to one of my schools, ORCA, Connections Academy, and he is 7 years old, and I'll probably defer to Mom because I think she knows him a little bit better than I do.
Representative Thatcher.
I won't wait my turn. Okay. Yes, this is my son, KJ Thatcher, and he's interested in playing the guitar and skateboarding and all kinds of good things like that. He hasn't decided what he wants to be when he grows up yet, but when he was younger, he wanted to either cut trees or hunt wolves. I had nothing to do with that, okay?
Thank you, and welcome to your capital. Representative Comp, a moment in history.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is my honor to recognize Francis Fuller Victor. Francis Fuller Victor came to Portland from San Francisco with her husband, a naval engineer. She was captivated by the novelty, grandeur, and romance of the Pacific Northwest. Traveling extensively, she met many Northwest notables, plying them with questions and becoming one of the West Coast's finest historians. Many volumes would flow from her pen. Colonel Joseph L. Meek, the notorious mountain man, supplied her stories that would end up in the book called The River of the West in 1870. After her husband died and needing money, Frances Victor worked at Hubert Howell Bancroft's publishing house. She was offered a 10-year contract but had to turn over all her extensive collections and research. There she helped produce and publish monumental works such as the first two volumes of Bancroft's History of the West. After quitting Bancroft in 1890, Frances returned to Oregon, living in Salem and Portland. To pay the bills, she sold face cream and other articles door to door, a dreary end for an important, very important literary figure in Oregon's history. Oregonians really ought to rediscover her.
Thank you. Further courtesies? Seeing none. Verification of quorum. The clerk will open the voting system to determine the presence of a quorum. Representative Gilman. Representative Maurer. Excused. Representative Galizio, Representative Shields, Representative Thompson. Excused for business of the House. Representative Cowan, Representative Hunt, Representative Buckley, Representative Clem, Representative Barker. Representative Berger, Representative Richardson. Quorum is present. Messages from the Governor. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform the Senate to pass House Bills 3405, 2649, 2009, 2116, concurrent in the House Amendments to repass Senate Bills 579, 640, 944. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform the Senate to pass Senate Bills 74, 190, 832, 726, House Bills 2629, 3139, 3489, pass the following House Bills as amended by the Senate. House Bill 2700, 2702, 2839, 3089, 3343, 2058, 3371, 3450, 2059. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform the to sign House Bills 5030, 5031, 2011, 2085, 2086, 2100, 8, 2153, 2155, 2156, 2163, 2165, 2205, 2207, 2219, 2249, 2262, 2269, 2272, 2276, 2277, 2278, 2304, 2308, 2311, 2318, 2333, 2353, 2360, 2394, 2408, 2462, 2510, 2621, 2630, 2738, 2953, 2755, 2911, 2953, 2956, 2963, 3256, HGM 8, 12, 20, 21, HGR 35, and 40, and 43. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President informing me to sign House Bills 5052, 2068, 2093, 2210, 2218, 2264, 2299, 2313, 2383, 2449, 2470, 2481, 2498, 2535, 2554, 2560, 2583, 2584, 2613, 2614, 2655, 2664, 2671, 2673, 2687, 2705, 2707, 2726, 2778, 2789, 2809, 2822, 2868, 2870, 2883, 2907, 2910, 2972, 3051, 3103, 3111, 3117, 3123, 3128, 3184, 3255, 3273, 3348, 3384, 3417, and HJM 3.
First readings, memorials, and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports, propositions and motions, first reading of House bills, second reading of House bills.
House Bill 5007 related to financial administration of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, appropriate money, declaring emergency. House Bill 5010 related to financial administration of the Employment Department, appropriate money, declaring emergency. House Bill 5016 related to financial administration of the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. House Bill 5026 relating to financial administration of the State Library, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. House Bill 5035 relating to financial administration of the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. House Bill 5039 relating to financial administration of Psychiatric Security Review Board, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. House Bill 2118 relating to licensing bonds. House Bill 2200 relating to program administering the state building code and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3225 relating to ballot measure 49-2007 claims and declaring an emergency.
Bills read the second time are passed to third reading. Consent calendar. Third reading House bills. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 5011 relating to financial administration of the Employment Relations Board, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5011A. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Ways and Means Committee brings you the budget bill for the Employment Relations Board. This agency is responsible for administering specific portions of Oregon's collective bargaining and labor relations laws. Here's what the staff of 13 does. Provides mediation services to state and local government employers, hears and decides unfair labor practice complaints, personnel appeals, and contested representation elections, and the three-member Labor Relations Board acts as the state's labor appeal court for labor and management disputes within state government. The agency is funded with a combination of general funds and other funds from fees for service and assessments on state agencies. The subcommittee recommends a budget of the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends $1,773,332 general fund and $1,808,088 other funds. The subcommittee recommendation includes the ratification of administrative fees and fees for service increased via administrative rule during the 07-09 interim and policy packages to maintain a legal subscription service not available through the state or local law libraries, and to replace computers per recommended replacement guidelines, to shift funding for a portion of a position from fee revenue to assessment revenue, and to continue reductions enacted as part of the 07-09 budget rebalance, consisting of a reduction of 0.25 FTE of each of two positions, a mediator and an administrative law judge, resulting in general fund savings, and approval of $8,786 in general fund for additional personal service expenses attributed to statewide adjustments to the classification of administrative law judges in the 07-09 interim. The Ways and Means Committee recommends approval of House Bill 5011 as amended. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Nathanson, do you wish to close? She does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Springer, how do you vote? Springer votes no. That does it. House Bill 5011A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 5012, relating to financial administration of the Employment Relations Board and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5012A. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 5012 ratifies fees adopted by the Employment Relations Board in the 07-09 interim, consistent with the Ways and Means Committee's recommendations on the agency's budget. Fee increases in this bill include the subscription rate for board orders, the per-page costs of transcripts or documents, costs for recordings of hearings, costs for copying, filing by facsimile, or we would say fax, and the hourly charge for training in interest-based bargaining. The fees, which are the subject of this bill, have not been increased since 1994, 1996, and 2000. The new fee structure will cover the agency's cost of providing information or service and are expected to amount to $14,630. Yes, that was a tiny number, $14,630, in additional revenue in the 09-11 biennium. The Ways and Means Committee recommends House Bill 5012 be approved as amended.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Nathanson, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
She does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Jensen votes aye. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Excuse for business. Representative David Edwards, how do you vote? Edwards votes aye. Representative Berger, how do you vote? She votes no. Representative Bentz, how do you vote? He votes no. House Bill 5012A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 5021, relating to financial administration of the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5021A. Representative We're going to take a short pause. Just a short little pause. As I was saying, the question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5021A. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My apologies, colleagues, for keeping me waiting. House Bill 5021A is the budget for the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. The Commission, which has jurisdiction over approximately 395 state judges, investigates and acts upon complaints of judicial misconduct or disability. The Commission's budget of $181,048 general fund dollars provides for one permanent part-time position. It's a half FTE. The Commission's budget includes $9,529, or 5% reduction from its essential budget level. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means also approved the Commission's key performance measures. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of House Bill 5021 as amended. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Buckley, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. House Bill 5021A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 5028, relating to financial administration of the long-term care ombudsman, appropriated money, and declared an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5028. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 5028 is the budget bill for the long-term care ombudsman, and I'll bet you did not even know such an agency existed. This agency recruits and trains local volunteers to help it identify, investigate, and resolve non-abuse complaints made by or on behalf of residents in long-term care facilities, where you and I may both, all of us, end someday. This agency also advocates for system changes that promote and protect the rights and its interests of these residents. General fund and federal matching funds support this agency's operations. Most of the general fund is used to match federal funds through the Department of Human Services. The department transfers the general fund and matching federal funds back to the agency where it is budgeted as the other funds. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means approved a $3.2 million total funds budget with 11 positions. This budget continues two deputy state long-term care ombudsman positions phased in during the 2007-09 biennium, but it restructures the agency to improve volunteer recruitment and retention. The restructuring eliminates the agency's deputy position and adds a full-time volunteer recruitment and management position. It makes other personnel and expenditure adjustments to reflect changing job duties and contracted support services. These changes do not add costs or position authority overall. With this restructuring, the agency expects to improve its timeliness in responding to complaints and resolving cases and increase the number of volunteers' visits to long-term care facilities across our state. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of House Bill 5028. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Tomei, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, sir.
She does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Kenemer, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Wingard, how do you vote? Votes aye. House Bill 5028, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Can we skip the order? Sorry, a second. We'll go to the next one. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 5048, relating to financial administration of the Department of Veterans Affairs, appropriated money, and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5048A. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 5048 is the budget bill for the Department of Veterans Affairs. The department operates three program areas. It operates mortgage loans to qualified veterans. It provides counseling and claims services, as well as conservatorship services and emergency and educational aid to veterans. And it operates the Oregon Veterans Home located in the Dalles. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means approved a total budget of $542 million with 110 positions. $488 million of the budget is non-limited other funds, principally for making loans and repaying debt. The balance, including $5.9 million of general fund, is for the operations and other program expenses of the department. The budget includes general fund reductions to help address the state's general fund revenue shortfall. The small business repair program established in 2008 is eliminated, as is support for national veterans organizations. The budget, however, does not reduce funding for the department's core counseling and assistance programs. Funding reductions to counties and to the conservatorship program are limited to the 6 to 7% range and are projected to have minimal impact to services. The budget finances a pilot program to assist student veterans in obtaining available benefits and counseling services. The department will add 5 veteran services officers who will serve directly on community colleges and Oregon University system campuses. This program is funded by other funds. The department will report on a program outcomes next session and may request continuation of the program at that time. Finally, the budget approves other funds expenditures to address a number of deferred maintenance and safety issues at the Salem Veterans Building and the Oregon Veterans Home. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends passage of House Bill 5048. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want you to think about this seriously, because right now we have a war going on and we have a lot of veterans that are coming back. I actually have something invested in this because I do have a son that is serving in the United States Air Force and has been to Iraq, Qatar, and is probably going back to Afghanistan. We need to make sure we support our vets to the fullest ability that we can at this time, and making any cuts to the budget for the Veterans Department is wrong. I urge your no vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Beyer, do you wish to close? She does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Greg Smith, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Barton votes aye. Representative Widener, for what purpose do you rise? House Bill 5048A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2167 related to distribution of 911 taxes.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2167A. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2167 comes to you with unanimous due pass recommendation from the Committee on Ways and Means. This is a housekeeping measure involving the distribution of 911 revenue. House Bill 2167 modifies statute to allow the payments of the Office of Emergency Management administrative costs to change from being retroactive to being proactive, with any excess being paid back to the 911 account. And as you all remember from the remonstrance yesterday, we all want to be proactive. It also provides the military department the authority to reimburse the preceding quarter's administrative expense as well as pay the current quarter's administrative expenses. Colleagues, there is no financial revenue, no fiscal or revenue impacts to this bill. It simply makes an accounting simpler and more efficient for both OEM and the military department. In the words of the great representative from Happy Valley, this is a good bill, should pass. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Freeman, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Springer, how do you vote? Springer votes aye. Representative Thatcher, how do you vote? Thatcher votes aye. Representative Barker, how do you vote? Barker votes aye. Representative Holvey, how do you vote? Holvey votes aye. Representative Gelser, how do you vote? Gelser votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Jensen votes aye. House Bill 2167A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2222, relating to State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and prescribing an effective date.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2222A. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2222A increases the surcharge paid on sport angler license and commercial vessel permits used to support the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Restoration and Enhancement Program, and extends the sunset on the surcharge to December 31, 2019. The bill maintains current other funds revenue in the Restoration and Enhancement Fund by extending the sunset and increases other funds by $2,361,233 through increases in the surcharge amounts. Revenues collected will be used to continue funding for 2.5 positions and for the projects that restore state-owned fish hatcheries, enhance natural fish production, expand hatchery production, and improve commercial salmon fisheries. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of House Bill 2222A.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Jensen, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Harker, how do you vote? Representative Harker votes aye. House Bill 2222A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2223, relating to State Department of Fish and Wildlife fees and appropriated money.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2223A, carried by Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2223A establishes new fees and modifies other fees related to wildlife and commercial fishing and establishes the Fish Passage Fund, which continuously appropriates to the Department of Fish and Wildlife for purposes related to fish passage. The bill will increase Department of Fish and Wildlife's other funds fee revenue by an estimated amount of $16.4 million in the 09-11 session and $20.1 million in the 11-13 biennia. Additional revenue raised will be used to cover enforcement improvements, recreation fishing and hunting enhancements, commercial fisheries management improvements, and the administration adjustments and enhancement. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of House Bill 2223A.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Jensen, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Garrett, how do you vote? Garrett votes aye. Representative Barker, how do you vote? Barker votes aye. House Bill 2223A, carried by Representative Jensen, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2442, relating to care providers appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2442B, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, we have a very serious problem in the state of Oregon, and House Bill 2442 is going to help us take the first necessary and important steps to fix that problem. Some of you may remember back in the fall of 2007, the Oregonian began running a series of stories about the gross and egregious incidents of abuse of adults with developmental disabilities in state-paid care in the state of Oregon. 1 in 5 adults with developmental disabilities receiving care in group homes or foster care homes had been victims of significant cases of abuse or neglect over a 7-year period. Many of those had been victimized more than once. Now, these are very serious incidents of abuse. You may wonder what they are. I've collected a list of them from the substantiated report files. Burned the back of a client's hand with a cigarette. Bound the victim with duct tape and restrained them to control them with behaviors, threatening them with a knife. Left the victim in clothes covered in feces, urine, and vomit. Pinched and grabbed victim in scrotum, willfully inflicting physical pain or injury. Hit victim on the forehead with an open palm while the victim was using the toilet. Struck victim with a stick, causing bruises. Allegedly entered victim's room, exposed genitals, and raped the victim. Colleagues, in 2006, there were 660 of these cases that were substantiated after an investigation. And of those, when the Department of Human Services reported those as a crime and called law enforcement and asked for a law enforcement investigation, law enforcement acted only 71 times out of those 660 cases. That's only 15%. And only 21 of those cases moved to a criminal prosecution. This is an embarrassment to our state. Every Oregonian has the right to be safe in their home. And every Oregonian, when they are the victim of a crime, has the right to expect that at the very least law enforcement will come out and investigate that crime. After the Oregonian profiled these cases, we all stepped up and said that we would address these as quickly as possible. And that's what we have here in House Bill 2442. We had a very large working group that gathered over the interim. It included all of the stakeholders, everyone from the Department of Justice to defense attorneys, self-advocates, the Council on Developmental Disabilities, the Department of Human Services, prosecutors, law enforcement. We were all at the table, and this is a comprehensive package that we have brought together to you, and I want to walk you through it. It is a very comprehensive bill. It is, in fact, a sweeping piece of legislation that will fundamentally change the way that we deal with abuse of adults with developmental disabilities in the state of Oregon. The first thing House Bill 2442 does is that it updates Oregon's abuse statutes by strengthening the definition of abuse. Right now, in current statute, adults with developmental disabilities have lesser and weaker protections than seniors and people with physical disabilities. Under this bill, they will have enhanced protection from those who might defraud an adult with developmental disabilities or steal their assets, and also greater protection from neglect and verbal abuse. In addition, under House Bill 2442, no matter where an adult with a developmental disability lives, an investigation can take place to make sure that they are safe. The bill also makes important improvements in the safety of the workforce. Under current law, there is nothing that prohibits an individual who has a prior conviction of rape, of abusing a person with a developmental disability or other vulnerable person, from identity theft, from working as a direct care provider, where they are the only person that has access to an individual. Under House Bill 2442, we will prohibit individuals who have been convicted of certain crimes, including sex crimes, identity theft, and violent crimes, from being hired into positions that give them direct access to vulnerable adults. House Bill 2442 also requires employers to disclose when abuse has previously occurred when they are called for a reference check. We talked about this in our public schools under House Bill 2062. This is basically the same function. If I have an employee who has been terminated from work for me and they had been substantiated of harming clients, this bill would require me to disclose that to the next employer. This is something the employers are very excited about, because what we found is not only do we have individuals who are repeatedly abused, we have abusers that are moving from county to county, group home to group home, foster home to foster home, without being stopped because there isn't a mechanism to share that information. This bill will also improve abuse investigations in the state of Oregon. It will require every county to train their investigators to the same standards and use the same forms and reports for investigations. It will also end the current practice of abuse investigators serving at the same time as case managers or service coordinators. That creates a very significant conflict of interest. The bill will also increase the criminal prosecutions of abuses against these vulnerable people. The bill mandates timelines for communication between the Department of Human Services, law enforcement, and district attorneys. This is going to help us better understand why some of these things aren't investigated and why some of them aren't prosecuted. There's a timeline on this. It is temporary, and so that we can study this and better understand it. The bill also creates multidisciplinary teams in every county so that all of the folks that are serving people with developmental disabilities can come together and work together to solve these abuse problems. The bill also increases, for the first time in decades, fines and civil penalties on those who have substantiated abuse for adults with developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, and seniors. Today, in the case of an egregious abuse, a fine can be as little as $50. $50. This bill will create a new minimum penalty of $2,500 for incidents that result in the rape, serious injury, or death of an adult with a disability or an elderly person. And you'll find on your desk a letter of support from the Oregon Healthcare Association. It is primarily their clients that will be paying these fees. There also will be an increase in licensing fees, which the Oregon Healthcare Association also supports, because those fees, as well as the fines and civil penalties, will go into a quality care fund that can only be used to improve training and quality improvement initiatives for people who are providing care to people with disabilities. If there are failures in the system, we need to use the penalties to reinvest in the system and make it better and safer. This bill will also raise awareness about abuse. It requires that the legislature be informed about the rate of abuse in direct care settings in Oregon. The biennial report will include data about the types of abuse, where they occur, and the outcomes of the abuse incidents. And this same report is going to draw a nexus, because it will include information about the types of training offered to direct care providers and direct care provider wages. Finally, the bill offers enhanced consumer protection. It ensures that when abuse occurs in a facility, in the home that someone lives in, that they will be notified that this has happened. In addition, their family, their case managers, and their guardians will also be informed, and their advocates. And individuals with disabilities and their family members will be informed of the availability of the report about the incidents of abuse provided to the legislature. They will also be regularly informed about how and when to report suspected abuse. Colleagues, this is a very good bill that has been a long time in the making. There are too many people that have worked on it to thank them all, but I would particularly like to offer my thanks to Lori Freeman in Legislative Council, who has drafted, redrafted, and redrafted again this bill and multiple amendments to it. At the same time, she was working on House Bill 2009. So if you see Lori in the hallway, thank her, because she's done some tremendous work for us this session. I also want to offer my thanks to the good chair of the Human Services Committee, who has worked so hard on this and to make it possible to pass the bill, as well as the representative from North Portland, and all of you that have contributed to making this a better bill. House Bill 2442 is about keeping a promise that we made to victims of abuse almost 2 years ago. Join me in keeping that promise to the most vulnerable among us by voting yes on House Bill 2442. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this is a bipartisan bill. There were only two of us that voted against it in Ways and Means, and my vote against it was merely to point out the fact that it's normally bad policy to institute a fund that receives its revenues from taking, whether it be penalties or forfeitures or whatever, and then uses those for the very purposes of, you know, from those, from what the money was taken. The best example of this is a law firm that, a police force that can capture or take forfeited property during the course of their investigations and then sell it and use it for their own police force. There's an inherent conflict of interest when certain enforcement will bring revenue to the body that's doing the enforcement. Previously, the enforcement of these statutes, the money would go to the general fund. Now it goes to a special fund that is earmarked to use by Department of Human Services. I think that's not good policy to do it this way. There's many good things about this bill, but I just wanted to explain why I'm voting no today.
Further discussion, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this is indeed a bipartisan bill and a very important bill. I gave you a statement just a few minutes ago about the long-term care ombudsman. What we learned when we had hearings about the long-term care ombudsman is that 60% of people in long-term care never get a visitor. We need something like this on the books that is going to be taking care of all those folks. When we look at ourselves, at our parents, at our grandparents, many of us are going to be ending up in these long-term care facilities. We need somebody out there watching out for us, and this bill helps to do that. Please vote yes on this bill.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Gelser, do you wish to close?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wanted to address the point that was raised about the conflict of interest of using the fines for a dedicated purpose. The reason that these funds are put not into the DHS general fund, which is where they went before, but into this designated quality care fund, is that the department has no incentive to institute fines because it can only be used for these quality improvement initiatives, which are approved and supported wholly by the people who will be paying these fines. The other thing that's important to remember is that in the bill there is actually a cap on these fines and civil penalties for facilities. So it's not like you can raise an unlimited amount of money in this way. I know that there was some discomfort and consternation in putting a cap on fines for rape, physical injury, and death. Ultimately, that is what we needed to do to be able to get this bill into a form that stands the constitutional test of passing this floor. But we need money to improve our training for the people that are providing these direct care services, and these people need the protection. Adults with developmental disabilities are not eligible for long-term care ombudsman services. We do very little to keep them safe. This bill will change that. They deserve it. They need it. Please join me in voting yes. Thank you.
Those of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Freeman, for what purpose do you rise? Okay. I think they're all done. House Bill 2442B, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Final readings, memorials, and resolutions. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the floor. Table. Close enough. We want them in. Oh. Representative Freeman, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request to return to the order of courtesies.
Representative Freeman requests unanimous consent that we return to the order of courtesies. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I want to take just a minute and introduce again to you my legislative assistant who's on the side aisle here, Julie Ryan Smith. Julie is a recent graduate, and I guess it's not that recent, it's been a little while now, of OSU, and it's a different OSU than you might be thinking. And she's been a fantastic legislative assistant this entire session, and she actually worked for me about a year before I got here. She has some special guests with her today, but I really wanted to make a point to tell you all what a great job she's done for me. She'll continue to work for me in the interim, and when you guys get a chance to talk to her, you'll see what a great personality and how pleasant she is to be around, and she clearly improves my attitude every day. So if you would extend courtesies to her, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Further courtesies, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Still on the order of courtesies, colleagues, please help me welcome today additional guests visiting all the way from Bowie, Maryland. Reverend Gary and Dr. Connie Rinesmith are with us today. These are Julie's parents. With them is my son, Brian Hanna, to our far right. And it is a special day that we introduce these guests as the Rinesmiths are future in-laws and Julie a future daughter-in-law. And please welcome them to the Capitol today.
Welcome to your Capitol, or at least your visiting Capitol. Thanks for being here. We were in the order of business of first reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 74 relating to interstate compact for adult offender of supervision and appropriated money. Senate Bill 190 relating to the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 726 relating to reservation of prize zones. Senate Bill 832 relating to state finance and declaring an emergency.
Bills read the first time are passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 496 relating to Oregon Growth Account and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 690 relating to personal income tax compliance and prescribing an effective date.
Bills read the second time are passed the third reading. Third reading of Senate bills. Clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 76 relating to Klamath River Dams and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 76B. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good morning, colleagues. Senate Bill 76 touches on a sweeping range of issues affecting the Klamath Basin. Issues ranging from dam removal to fish habitat and water rights. This bill, colleagues, is a small piece of a much larger process that may result in profound changes for this vital region of Oregon. For tribes and some farmers, this may lead to the settlement of a century of dispute over water rights. For fish, this may lead to the possible restoration of runs in this once wild river system. And this process may lead to the reconfiguration of electric supplies that would accompany the removal of the Klamath River dams. And colleagues, these are profound changes that are contemplated for the Klamath Basin. They will create many winners. They may create some losers. They are controversial and emotional changes. This legislature is obligated to move cautiously and humbly on any issue that touches this larger process. But this bill, colleagues, Senate Bill 76, is not a vote on the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. This is a vote on a bill that does essentially one thing. It establishes a surcharge for Pacific Core customers for the purpose of Klamath Dam removal or relicensing. It caps that surcharge at $200 million to be spread among the customers, Pacific Core customers of California and Oregon, to be collected over 10 years. The cost to Oregon ratepayers of this surcharge would be approximately $1.50 per ratepayer per month. Essentially, colleagues, this bill caps the costs for Pacific Core customers related to the potential removal of the Klamath River dams. But make no mistake, this bill alone does not settle the issue of what happens to these dams, does not settle the issue of whether they are relicensed or removed. Here are the steps that would have to take place, colleagues, before the Klamath River dams are removed. First, passage of this bill. Second, a final agreement between the federal government, the state of Oregon, California, and Pacific Corps related to this process. Third, a determination of the Oregon PUC that the imposition of Oregon's share of the $200 million in this bill would result in rates that are fair, just, and reasonable. Fourth, the passage of a California bond measure to provide $250 million of additional funds for dam removal. Fifth, the passage of federal legislation limiting liability for dam removal. Sixth, a determination by the Department of Interior as to whether $450 million, the $200 million that this bill would authorize to be set aside, plus the $250 million related to the California bond, determination as to whether that $450 million will be sufficient to cover dam removal. And seventh, a determination in 2012 by the U.S. Department of Interior as to whether dam removal is prudent. And eighth, the selection of a dam removal entity by the U.S. government. That's before we even begin the process of removing these dams. But if we don't pass this bill, colleagues, we make it unlikely that the federal government, California, Oregon, and Pacific Corps reach final agreement on a path forward for dams that is prudent and fair. We jeopardize the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement that brought 20 parties, including tribes, fishers, farmers, conservation groups, and state and federal agencies to the table for voluntary settlement of water rights in the Klamath Basin and the restoration of fish runs in the Klamath River, along with other provisions designed to provide greater certainty for farmers, for fishers, and for tribes. If we fail to pass this bill, we saddle Pacific Corps and its ratepayers, my constituents and many of yours, with continued uncertainty about their exposure to costs associated with removal or relicensing of the dams. Before I close by asking you to vote aye for this bill, I want to talk a little about the issue that we spent more time on than any other when it came to this bill, the issue that opponents drew to our attention, and I appreciate them for doing so. And that was the question of what liability might the taxpayers of this state incur? Because it's very clear, colleagues, clear to me, that this bill provides reasonable certainty for Pacific Corps' ratepayers. It was not as clear to me that the bill provides that same level of certainty for the taxpayers of Oregon. But here's what we learned as we explored that issue over several committee meetings, a number of conversations outside of committee, and several long work sessions. First, the Department of Justice memo, Oregon Department of Justice memo, that concludes that there is a low risk of state taxpayer liability. Why? Well, because of the right of withdrawal provisions that are built into the final agreement that the agreement in principle signed last year related to Klamath Dam removal contains. Oregon can withdraw from this agreement at the point when the Secretary of Interior decides to go forward or not. There are right of withdrawal provisions along the way to ensure that Oregonians get a good deal under this bill and under the agreement that it anticipates. That's one reason your Environment and Water Committee concluded that this is a good deal for Oregon taxpayers. Second, an amendment we adopted at the request of ICNU, the Farm Bureau, that clarifies what costs can be passed on to customers. An amendment that clarifies what costs can be passed on to customers. Third, an amendment suggested by representative from the Bedrock District, Representative Smith, that clarifies that there could be no taxpayer liability associated with the passage of this bill. And fourth, conclusion in looking at the studies associated with the question of sediment built up behind this dam, studies that have reached different conclusions but which are indeterminate at this point to the question of whether or not there is sufficient risk related to what may be in those sediments or sufficient amount of sediments for us to conclude that we shouldn't go forward with more studies, because that's all that this bill and the larger process that it's part of will lead to, and that is additional studies between now and 2012 before any determination is made related to removal of the dams. And based on what we saw in those studies, there's no significant reason to think that the sediments behind those dams wouldn't be washed through within a couple of years, or that the sediments in those dams contain hazardous substances that would add significantly to the costs associated with dam removal. Maybe those sediments are there. Maybe these studies are wrong, but if we pass this bill, we're obligated to do additional studies before a final determination by the Department of Interior about dam removal. Colleagues, this bill is supported by conservation groups, by our electrical utility, Pacific Corps, by ratepayer advocates, by fisheries groups. I won't read them all, but here are a few. The Nature Conservancy, the Grants Pass and Josephine County Chamber of Commerce, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishery Associations, Trout Unlimited, the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, Pacific Corps, the Confederated Tribes of the Ward Springs, the Klamath Water Users Association, the Upper Klamath Water Users Association, Citizens Utility Board, the Oregon Business Association, the Klamath Tribe, Sustainable Northwest, the Northwest Sports Fishing Industry Association. This process has been endorsed by the editorial boards of the Klamath Falls Herald and News, the Medford Mail Tribune, and the Oregonian. I hope you'll consider the issues involved here carefully, colleagues. They are complicated. This is part of a larger process, but this bill provides certainty for Oregon's ratepayers. It provides a good deal for Oregon taxpayers. It helps lead to the potential settlement of issues of great difficulty in the Klamath Basin for fish and for farmers, and I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Girard.
To the bill, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill.
The good representative from Northeast and Southeast Portland just read a whole bunch of names of people who supported dam removal. What he didn't talk about was the 65% of the residents, the people, the real people of the Klamath Basin, don't favor dam removal. This is my district, colleagues. It's the only district 100% affected by this bill. There used to be that it meant a little bit to the members of this group that if the representative from the district didn't like a bill, that used to be honored. It isn't anymore. Senate Bill 76 is a bill about removing dams in the Klamath Basin, and it does cap the cost of dam removal. And it does one other little thing. It exempts Pacific Corps and the state of Oregon from all environmental liabilities. Why? The answer is nobody knows. Two feasibility studies have already been done on dam removal, one by the Army Corps of Engineers. They indicate a high risk that there's going to be some real environmental problems after you take these dams out. You see, this bill is a domino. It's the first domino. You've seen those dominoes that are stacked on their ends about a half inch apart in a long row. And when you tip the first one over, the whole row eventually collapses. That's what this bill is all about. It's that first domino that's going to cause all the other dominoes to fall. And to be honest, nobody knows what those dominoes even represent at this point. When the dams come out, you can bet there's going to be toxic sludge behind those dams. They've been there for 100 years, producing electricity, green electricity, hydroelectric power. And you want to take them out. That's wonderful. What are you going to replace them with? Oops, nobody knows. Except the ratepayers in every one of your districts are going to pay for this. Because every one of you have Pacific Corps in your district. And you are going to get a telephone call asking, what the heck is this $1.50 charge surcharge for? Well, you can always say $1.50 isn't that much. It's toward dam removal. please understand the severity of what we do here today. Because if you vote this for this bill, this will be the largest dam removal in the history of the United States. It will be, discounting World War II, where we blew up a couple dams, it will be the largest dam removal in the world. That's what you're voting on today, to start those dominoes. To start those dominoes flowing. And you don't know what's going to happen after they take them out. Are there going to be floods? How much wildlife is going to be killed from onrushing torrents of water and sludge and stuff that's been behind those dams? That's not going to be a picnic area. But the real key to this bill that you should be asking yourself, that you're contemplating voting for, is liability. The liability that may be incurred by the state of Oregon as a result of dam removal is one of the outstanding questions with this bill. And as you consider the legislation, it's imperative to remember Section 8.
Representative Bruin yields.
Thank you, Representative. Section 8 of the B engrossed bill doesn't do anything to resolve this question. The bill reads, Sections 2 to 8 of this 2009 Act do not create a cause of action against the state of Oregon or against any of the officers, employees, or agents of the state, and may not be used as the basis for an assertion of liability on the part of the state of Oregon or any officer or employees or agents of the state. And you know what that means? There's no liability for the state. No environmental liability. Why? When we offered an amendment in the Environment Committee to remove those exemptions and say, hey, if you're going to take the dams out, you're going to be responsible for what happens after you take them out. A representative of the governor's office testified that was a poison pill. What does that tell you about liability on this issue? There's a lot of very strong people with a lot of power that want these dams out. And it's all part of a very intricate plan. There's no question about that. For ultimate water adjudication rights in the Klamath Basin. Nobody wants my farmers to have a consistent supply of water guaranteed than I do. I stood right on this floor 8 years ago, when the Bucket Brigade was started, when the federal government cut off water to the farmers. And the people who had that water cut off are the same people who want the dams out. It is interesting. One of the key folks in this is the Klamath tribes, who last week had an editorial in the Oregonian and in my own Klamath Falls Herald and News. The good senator and myself, who represent this district, have opposed dam removal. The tribes publicly told the two of us, quote, get out of the way. Gosh, I thought we represented the people of Oregon and the people of our districts. So are the tribes telling the people of Oregon, get out of the way and let us remove those dams so we can get our salmon back? Wonderful. The good representative from southwestern Oregon will further testify this morning about that salmon restoration that may be a little bit of smoke and mirrors. But we don't know, because there has been a feasibility study, two of them, and they say the risks are high, but we haven't done the feasibility study on whether the salmon could ever return. But let's go take the dams out before we know the answers to all those. That makes a lot of sense. Let's take the dams out, and then we'll worry about whether we can get the fish back afterwards. The governor of this state has publicly stated he intends to use $4 million of stimulus dollars, let me underline the word stimulus, for a feasibility study on our dam removal. That's a wonderful use of stimulus funds. Wonder how many jobs that'll create. Well, at least a couple, probably in the right areas. With all due respect, colleagues, I don't think the members of this body, and I include myself, are qualified to render a decision on the merits of this dam removal, because we simply don't have enough answers yet. But our governor wants this done. PacifiCorps wants this done. And it's odd, the people that are going to pay for it, you and I, and many members of our districts, they don't want it.
Representative Esquivel yields.
I will, in conclusion, suggest that after we get the feasibility study to find out whether the dam removal will, in essence, do what they say it will do, that until we get that study, we don't need this bill. When we get that study and it shows that salmon can be restored and that there's going to be no serious environmental aspects to dam removal, that's going to be a whole different ballgame. And I may be standing before you asking you to go ahead and pass the bill. But right now, no. It's not right. We need some answers before we pass this. But the people who want this bill passed want it passed now, so they can start charging your constituents. It'll be interesting to see how some of you in Portland and Eugene explain to your constituents why you're paying for dam removal in California. Three of the dams, by the way, are in California. You're going to be paying for your constituents. What you have before you is a bill that authorizes the largest dam removal in the history of the United States. When you press your button today, that's the domino you're starting to fall. Think carefully, and please guide your vote accordingly. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I echo the sentiments of the representative from Southeast and Northeast Portland. The matter before us today leads to all sorts of complexities. In my view, our specific duty in regards to Senate Bill 76 is a very simple one. We must decide if Senate Bill 76 protects ratepayers. That's it. We're not here to fight for or against dam removal, or for or against salmon, or for or against protecting the environment. The issue before us is protecting ratepayers. And once we set everything else aside, the choice is very simple. Whether you support dam removal or not, Senate Bill 76 does protect ratepayers. Whether you want wild salmon or hatchery salmon, Senate Bill 76 protects ratepayers. Whether you want to ski in a dam-produced reservoir or fish in an unfettered river, Senate Bill 76 protects ratepayers. There are so many things that must occur long after we vote today on Senate Bill 76 that will determine if and ever a single portion of a single dam is ever removed along the Klamath River, much less four dams. California voters, our federally elected senators and representatives, and even the U.S. Secretary of the Interior will all have their say in the matter. Even then, there's no guarantee we'll ever get to a dam removal scenario. Opponents of dam removal, you will have many more opportunities to have your say. Proponents of dam removal, you will have the same myriad of opportunities. But today, we have the chance to protect ratepayers, no matter where this thing twists and turns from here. We have this one task before us. Everyone else will have those opportunities, but the ratepayers need us today. Senate Bill 76 protects the little guy, the average homeowner who welcomes a rate cap and the certainty that Senate Bill 76 brings, no matter who wins the great debate. I'm voting yes today on Senate Bill 76, and I'm joining a remarkable coalition behind this bill, a historic coalition, because the average Oregonian needs us to protect them. They need the rate cap. They need to know no matter how the larger political debate plays out, we had their backs today with the passage of Senate Bill 76. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. First, to declare a conflict.
And state the conflict.
About 10 years ago, Mr. Speaker, I was asked by former Representative Kip Lombard to take over the representation of a number of claimants in the Upper Klamath Basin. Sadly, he was passing away from brain cancer, and I accepted his suggestion that I represent his clients, and I still represent them today. In addition, I know personally a very large number of the ranchers and some of the farmers that are in the Klamath Basin, and have they've been family friends for many, many years.
So noted for the record.
To the bill.
To the bill.
And Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry, I have some questions for the carrier.
Questions of the carrier. Will the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Representative, what are the undepreciated amounts Pacific Corps has invested in the four Klamath dams?
Thank you for the question, and thank you for getting it to me in advance. I was able to talk to the utility about that question to get a precise answer. There is currently $62.5 million in undepreciated investment in the dams. That's about the equivalent of what it would cost to buy 25 megawatts of wind. And accelerating that depreciation over 10 years, as anticipated by this bill, would cost marginally more than depreciating that over the remaining perhaps 20, 30, or 40 years of the dams if they were to be relicensed for that period.
Mr. Speaker, another question of the carrier.
Further question of the carrier. Will the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. What is the amount Pacific Corps has spent on relicensing the Klamath dams to date?
Thank you again for the question. They have spent approximately $56 million in costs today so far on potential relicensing. That's $56 million for legal fees, for studies, for personnel time. They've sunk that much in without obtaining a license or getting anywhere near yet obtaining a license, and that's before the mitigation costs that would be required along with a license. So they're spent a lot of money. They are only a little bit of the way.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A third question of the carrier.
Another question for the carrier. Will the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. What is Pacific Corps' 2008 annual revenue requirement?
Thank you. Just over $1 billion.
Follow up, Mr. Speaker.
Another question for the carrier. Will the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Is that annual revenue requirement for just Oregon or for all of Pacific Corps' territory?
That is just Oregon.
Follow up.
Another question for the carrier. Will the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. And what is the annual revenue requirement for all of Pacific Corps' service area?
I'm sorry that I do not have the answer to that question.
Final question for the carrier.
Another question for the carrier. Will the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. What are the allocated shares of power for states that have received the lower cost power generated by the Klamath River dams?
Thank you for the question, and it's an interesting one. Oregon has received historically more than 50% of the benefit from these dams. So Pacific Corps has six states in its service territory. The majority of the benefits from these dams and the low-cost hydropower that they have provided have accrued to Oregon more than 50%.
Thank you very much, Representative. Mr. Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, some might ask why the representative from far eastern Oregon would be concerned about the Klamath project, and the answer is that all of us in eastern Oregon are dramatically dependent upon water. There isn't a day that doesn't pass that we don't worry about water. It struck me, though, that this is hardly a condition that is isolated to eastern Oregon. In fact, if I look up the Santiam River, I see the Detroit Dam, which stores some of the water that's used right here that was used this morning in this city. If I look up the river from Portland, I see Bull Run Reservoir and a dam that holds that water back without fish passage. Same for Detroit Dam. If I look above Eugene, I see Cougar Dam with the quite possibly the poorest fish passage one could imagine. And it supplies water to Eugene. So we have three dams without fish passage supplying water to about 1 million people. We in eastern Oregon become extraordinarily concerned when we see activities involving our dams in our part of the state driven by folks from Portland, Eugene, Salem. We become concerned because there's very few of us over there. We worry because there isn't a great deal of difference between the dams I just mentioned and those that are on the Klamath, except there's a much smaller group of people benefiting from them. So we are concerned. This is not to say that the dams should remain. The dams are small. The dams are old. The dams interfere with the passage of fish. The dams are not necessarily that green. So, handled appropriately, dams can be removed. The problem with this bill before us today is it reflects bad process and a policy that we should not today encourage. The policy is this, and before I comment on how we got here, then I want to say that the governor and his staff, Pacific Corps and their staff, the tribes and their lawyers have worked incredibly hard to get where we are today. The problem is they started out on a false premise, and that is that they had to use secrecy and a behind closed doors method of reaching where we are today. All of us, I don't know how many times I've heard the word transparency here since I arrived 5 months ago. This process is not transparent. Was not transparent, and I think if we were to ask the governor's office, the tribes, and the Pacific Corps, they would assure you they couldn't have gotten this far unless they had kept what they were doing hidden. That's unfortunate. And it's not the type of policy or process we as a group want to encourage. A vote today does just that. It encourages bad policy, bad process, and secrecy in something that affects literally tens of thousands of people. In my part of the state, a water right is the foundation upon which you premise your future. When you go to plan your estate, when you figure out what you're going to pass on to your kids, you look at your water right. That's what makes your ranch, your farm, even your little town worth something, the right to divert water. Without it, you're nothing. That means that the state's ability to protect those rights is absolutely essential. And today, by voting for this bill, we are basically saying we are not interested in protecting your rights. That's what we're saying. Some would say this bill, and some have said, that this bill is merely a first step and we can easily get off the train. That is incorrect. This process is hugely complex, and this piece of that process starts something that will not be easily stopped. Now, if you choose to vote no, and I hope you do, does that damage this process? The answer is probably not. And here's why. A no vote would force the groups to go back, gather up those they didn't have along for the ride, and bring them into the process, making it better and much more likely to survive the next couple of steps. Some would say, if we don't pass the bill today, there's going to be much more money that folks would have to spend. This $18 would somehow...
Representative Freeman yields.
Thank you, Representative. Somehow that $18 would blossom into something much larger. In fact, it would. Next year, it would be $20. And the year after that, it would be $22. So a delay hardly creates more difficulty for the ratepayer. While I'm on that topic, this bill is not just about protecting the ratepayer. In fact, I would draw your attention to portions of the bill that talk about costs in addition to the $200 million. $200 million is called out as the cap upon the cost of dam removal, but no one has said a word about the additional items Pacific Corps gets to pass on to the ratepayers. Not a word today until I ask the carrier the questions I asked earlier. Pacific Corps will be allowed to adjust its rates to take into account dam removal and the replacement power that's going to cost and all of the other things that go with it. The cost of relicensing, for example, $56 million, that will be passed on to the ratepayer under this bill. The undepreciated amounts, those are the amounts that are talked about and the amounts that they're going to put together the reserve account for. If you look into how protected the ratepayer is, I believe you'll find, as I did, I think, this morning in talking to some folks about this, that it's not the $1 billion that's the measure of the limitation, it's the 10. That would mean that another $50 million could be tacked on to the ratepayers each year. That's the lid. And that's in addition to that which we heard about earlier. This bill is the end of the cap on a preordained result in the allocation of water in the basin. The key to the allocation of water in the basin is a tribe's claim. The tribe's claim is limited by this agreement in principle, which this bill is built upon and in essence approves. The agreement in principle is built upon the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, which calls out that which the tribes are going to receive. The point is, a very complex deal has been struck behind closed doors, the result of which will be an allocation of a limited amount of water to the tribes, but that in turn gives the farmers in the basin the amount of water they get, and that in turn calls out those who won't get any water. The adjudication process was supposed to do this. This bill, in large part, moots, preordains, calls out the result of the adjudication process, and that's wrong. If the message we want to send today is that we approve behind closed doors dealings, and if we approve a method other than the normal, legal, called out, correct approach to allocating water, then you would vote yes for the bill. If we vote no, I hope we send this bill back. We give the folks an opportunity to get together and do this right, which is possible. We also might want to do a better job of calling out to the ratepayers the costs they're going to incur. I strongly recommend a no vote. I believe the future is going to be review after review after review of dams and the damage they do. We don't want to set this type of a precedent for those future processes. Again, I don't say that dams can't come out. What I do say is we got to go about it right. This bill is a reflection of the wrong way to do it. I urge your no vote.
Further discussion, Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill.
Question of the carrier.
I'm sorry? Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Good representative. I did give him these ahead of time because I want the facts to come out. What was the original reason, underlying reason for the dam removal?
Proponents of dam removal, and keep in mind this bill does not actually remove dams, and we'll have more discussion of that, I'm sure. But proponents of dam removal would agree, I think, that the primary reason to contemplate going down that path would be to restore fish runs in this basin.
Thank you.
Representative Greer?
Additional questions?
Additional questions? Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Do you know what percent of the fish were lost to the dam?
Thank you also for that question. The information I have suggests that today Klamath salmon runs are at best less than 10% of their historic numbers. Now, when you look at the impact of dams on that, it is pretty clear. The first of these four dams was built in 1916. Had no fish passage of any sort, simply cut off migrating salmon and steelhead access to more than 600 miles, stream miles, of once fully occupied spawning and rearing habitat above the dams. Subsequent three dams did the same. The Klamath River once produced the third largest salmon runs in the nation. So runs are at 10% of the level they were. Clearly, the dams have played a significant role in the loss of those runs. Representative Greer?
Further question.
Further questions? Does the carrier yield?
I do. He does.
Do you know what percent of the cold Trinity River water was diverted to Southern California?
Thank you also for that question. Historically, up to 90% of the water from the Trinity was diverted to the Central Valley rather than running into Klamath. Although that changed, and as of 2006, about 50% of the water in the Trinity is not diverted and provides flows for fish. But keep in mind that the Trinity flows are not a primary contributor to the salmon problem, since the Trinity flows enters the Klamath just 40 miles upstream from the ocean, and the majority of the lack of suitable flows in the Klamath are above the Trinity River. So the problem area for salmon is above the confluence of the Trinity and Klamath Rivers.
Representative Krieger?
To the bill, please.
To the bill.
Colleagues, you've heard today about costs, race, et cetera, and specifically about the Trinity. It comes in at 40 miles or so above, and if that water was, in fact, mixed with the upper river water and cooled it, the fish wouldn't be moving upstream looking for cooler water to start with. I want to talk to you a little bit about, as I've indicated, the underlying reason for the dam removal. Almost every instance there is, and we took them out on the rogue, actually is salmon. But if it's based on a false premise and misunderstanding of the science at the time, I think we're heading down the wrong track. I spent 5 years in Klamath Falls, 2 years when I was going to school, 5 years with the state police, game division. And believe it or not, I was assigned the area from Klamath Falls, all of the river, right down to the border of California. If the dams are taken out, you're going to be dumping 73-degree plus water directly onto the Chinook salmon in the lower Klamath. And I'm guessing, what will that do? The problem is the water withdrawal from the Trinity, which is cold, and taken to Southern California. California has created their own problem, and dam removal won't bring the Klamath salmon run back. I've been working with the Department of Fish and Wildlife for a couple months here regarding some new information on predation, specifically avian predation, and its effect on our salmon. And just yesterday, the Coastal Caucus heard the devastating effects of predators on our salmon and steelhead. Again, it was specifically avian or bird predators. The Nehalem study, which I have here from 2002, was actually started in 2009 through 2002. It was conducted by the Oregon Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Oregon State University, with Carl Schreck and Daniel Roby as the principal investigators. What did the study say? I think we need to understand that this was done after they started the study on the Klamath that got them to the conclusion. So the information they are basing their dam removal on in this need is false. 50% of our wild smolt, salmon, and steelhead, basically in the Nehalem watershed are taken by cormorants before they reach the ocean. I was astounded. Even though I've been working with the department, I'd never heard those figures. Nobody acknowledged it. 50% or more. Also, the ALSI study done in 2001 showed that 21% of adult coho returning are consumed by harbor seals. Mergrants are taking another undocumented percent. The Columbia has the largest double-crested cormorant colony in the world, and it's growing. And then there's the Caspian terns, which also take a million. Seals are also taking up-migrating smolts, and studies are underway, and it's believed that those takings are going to be significant in the millions. And we wonder why we can't recover salmon. It seems like we're really ignoring the most obvious thing that many of us, many farmers, ranchers, commercial fishermen could tell you, hey, this is a problem, but we've never been able to measure it to the degree that we have now. There are other studies such as trends in abundance and current status of harbor seals in Oregon from 1977 to 2003. Those numbers are growing. Another one on assessment of harbor seal predation, adult salmon in the Pacific Northwest estuary, also finding the same thing. They are a major problem. We're not going to recover by taking dams out, making watershed quality investments. The salmon report from 2009 was published by Senator Bob Morton of Washington, and it deals about predators, specifically the Columbia. Same conclusion. The Klamath River, in my mind, is really a scheme that's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars and won't recover salmon, and the environmental damage from the sediment is unknown. It is really, in fact, that we need time to do the proper research, and we're going to find that predation is taking somewhere between 70 and 80% of both wild and hatchery production of smolts before they ever reach the ocean. There's not a lot we can do. We increase it. The numbers of predators increase just as fast as we're increasing production. We're putting $40 million of biennium into our hatcheries, and we're just letting predators eat it up. We have spent those billions of dollars,
Representative Mauer yields,
in watershed restoration to help recover salmon and not seen those expected benefits. And that's because the freshwater habitat isn't the limiting factor in salmon production. We need to manage predators like we do most other wildlife. You can't have unregulated numbers of predators. It's not the dams. They take about 1% to 3% depending on what stream they're on. It is the predators. All science points to predation as the main cause of salmon decline and our inability to recover wild salmon. The same extreme environmentalists who want to take the dams out in the Klamath also want to take them out on the Snake, and they'll move to the Columbia over time. Yesterday we talked about electric cars and the new batteries. Where do you think that electricity will come from? Some people act like you just plug into Mother Nature and it's going to recharge their car. It's not going to happen. We have to replace this energy with renewable energy. We're not doing that. I think we should be keeping our dams, and we should make them go back to the board and find a solution when we really know the science. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I promised our good partners in power generation that I wouldn't speak to the bill, and I'm semi-breaking that promise. It really isn't about the substance of the bill. What my concern here is, okay, we as a community have made a decision. Several decades later, we decide maybe we'll make a different decision, and that's fine. But if we continue, if this sets a precedent, and it may not, we're going to have to ask ourselves, how are we going to replace this power, and who's going to pay for it? And that is the question, and it's going to continue to be the question. This is called the Dam Removal Bill. Well, I sponsored and carried a bill that some people call the Dam Removal and Fill Bill. And some folks that support this bill adamantly oppose that bill. Well, we can't have it both ways. We either have energy generation and transmission, or we don't. You can't say you're for green energy and then deny this community the ability to site generation plants, whether they be floating in the ocean or blowing in the wind or running in the stream, and then deny the transmission of that power. You can't have it both ways. It's one or the other. So there's a broader picture, a broader question, a broader subject here than just this simple little, not so little to many topic. And I do not think anyone should be told to get out of the way. But and I'm sorry that was part of the process, and I will be voting no.
Further discussion, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill.
To the bill. Colleagues, I've heard a lot of, as you have, a lot of good discussion on this bill. And with some of the eloquence from some of the speakers, it's made me hesitant to stand today to offer some of my concerns that I have with this dam removal and with this process. I'm, as all of you know, basically a country boy at heart and in spirit. I was raised on a farm, ranch. My mother just rolled over in her grave. It was never a farm. It was always a ranch. And have spent my entire life in rural communities, rural settings, with the exception of a few minor years along the way. When I came to Oregon in 1967, one of the things that really attracted me to Oregon was a healthy, vibrant natural resource economy. It was the types of things that, you know, were attractive to me, that my kind of culture centered around. Since that time, I have seen a constant and continual shrinking of those communities. The statistics are pretty easy to get at, pretty easy to see. Look at any of the historical data, and you'll see the population has been going down, down, down. And my good friend, neighboring district, Marr County, when I came to Oregon, had the second highest income per capita of any county in the state. While it's doing better now than it was a few years ago, it's a long ways from that, and the unemployment rates are high. I look at some of your counties, and the same things are true. The population has been shrinking. The economies are in the tank. Our young people are leaving. And our community has become smaller and smaller and smaller. I'm sorry, but in this proposed project on the climate, I see just one more step in doing the same thing. There are farms and farmers there that are going to be gone in a few years after, if the dams are removed, after those dams are removed. The community will shrink. That was for those of you sports fans, that was a powerhouse in Oregon when I came to Oregon. And I'm not saying they're not, you know, good and all those things now, but they're nowhere where they were 40 years ago. I look at even some of the communities in the valley. I drive once in a while across a mountain to Bend. And as I drive up the river, on the way up the mountain, I see these little mill towns that a few years ago were vibrant little communities, and today they're ghost towns. Okay, you say a change in time, maybe. But as a representative from those communities, I ask you to think about that before you proceed further down this path of the destruction of rural America.
Representative and Matthews Yields.
Colleagues, this is what I see these efforts to be, a destruction of rural America. Our little schools are gone or going. Our kids have no place to come home to. Nothing there for them. Yeah, I know all kids go off to college and they want to, you know, they want to go to the big time and be in the big city and all that. I went through exactly the same thing with my children. They went off to college, my second son. He was never in his life coming back to Pendleton, except maybe to pass through to see his father while he was going from one place to another. He has an office in downtown Pendleton today. I plead with you to think about rural Oregon and to think about what is there when we make the decisions that we make in this body. Thank you very much for your indulgence. I'm sorry.
Further discussion, Representative Jefferson Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
I spent a lot of time on this bill, more than the stakeholders and the governor's office wanted me to spend. And we might be back to this issue in the future, and I want to offer just a bit on the liability question and to get some words on the record. So there is a multi-party agreement in principle that would lay out how this is going to get paid for, if it's going to happen. If it's up to $200 million, removal or relicensing up to $200 million, Pacific Core ratepayers will pay. The next $250 million will be paid by a California bond that hasn't passed yet but is in the works, according to my most recent understanding. And we don't know yet what happens if it's over $450 million. The agreement in principle is not yet a final agreement. Through the amendment that we worked, we wanted to send a very clear signal, and I personally wanted to make sure that Oregon taxpayers wouldn't be left holding the bill, so that going forward in those negotiations, I want to say on the record that the negotiators have to make sure that we resolve not only that $250 million California question, but also the supra $450 million question, that Oregon taxpayers won't be left holding that bill, that question needs to be answered, and that the answer isn't the constituents of the people in that room. And I'll leave it there. In this room.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Cannon, do you wish to close?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I appreciate the discussion. I want to respond to a few points. One, we don't know enough to remove these dams. We heard that several times. Well, that is absolutely right. We do not know enough at this point in time to decide on removing these dams, which is why under this bill and under the agreement in principle that we expect to lead to a final agreement this summer, there are a number of checks on the process that may ultimately result in the removal of dams. And one of those checks that the state of Oregon continues to reserve is the determination, the obligation that our Public Utilities Commission has to ensure that removal of dams is a fair and reasonable and prudent course for Oregonians, Oregon ratepayers.
Another issue, how to explain to our constituents that $1.50 surcharge that would start showing up on their bills next year. What do we say about that? Well, I think we say if they're a customer of PacifiCorp, and that's who would see that $1.50 surcharge, their utility has a big problem, has a big challenge. It has these four old dams on the Klamath River, four old dams that either need to be relicensed because their licenses have expired or need to be decommissioned and possibly removed. And those courses are costly. Either way, it's costly. PacifiCorp estimates, based on experience with dam relicensing around the country, that relicensing process alone would include $350 million in required fish mitigation efforts, fish ladders, and the like. $350 million as a starting point for the costs of relicensing those four dams. Under Senate Bill 76, customer liability associated with dam removal would be capped at $200 million, with the balance, if there is one, coming from the sources that my colleague from the Bedrock District said. So this is a good deal for ratepayers. PacifiCorp's got a problem. These dams that are going to be costly to relicense or remove, this bill caps ratepayer liability in the case that it goes down the path of removal. We heard about the extreme environmentalists supporting the bill. I'll remind you of some of the other folks supporting the bill. Don't know whether they're extreme. I don't think so. Pacific Coast Federation of Fisheries Associations, Association of Northwest Steelheaders, Klamath Water Users Association, Upper Klamath Water Users Association, Klamath Tribes, etc., etc. I read the list before, at least portions of it. This is remarkable that we've gotten to this point of a diverse group of stakeholders agreeing to engage in this process, a process that might in 2020, after a number of determinations have been made by this legislature, by the people of California, by our Congress, by the Department of Interior, after additional studies have been done, might result in dam removal. The impact of this potential course on fish is important because we've heard, we know about the impact on our fisheries, our coastal fisheries, that have resulted from the loss of salmon habitat. This is an economic crisis for parts of the state. And it's, I think, perfectly obvious that the reason why the fishing community is so supportive of this bill is because of the possibility that we would restore what was once one of the very most productive salmon runs in the country. We heard that there is a broader picture here related to our electrical supplies. My colleague from Happy Valley, and I appreciate his bringing it to our attention because that's one of my priorities as well, and we explored that issue in committee. We take out these dams, we're going to get the power from somewhere else. The 86 megawatts, these are old dams. These are relatively small dams. This is an average annual capacity of 86 megawatts, about 1% of PacifiCorp's total resources. But it's true. That power will need to come from somewhere else. And it's important that we have the right policies in place to ensure or encourage that those to come from other types of renewable resources, that the replacement power is green. But I appreciate that broader picture, and it's one that we'll need to keep in mind as this legislature and the state considers the decommissioning and possible removal of these dams. So, colleagues, there's been plenty of debate on this bill. I think you've heard good airing of the issues. Appreciate the hard work of the Environment and Water Committee, who spent a good deal of time on the issue. Recognize that it brings up strong feelings, strong emotions on both sides of the issue. I think this is just a little piece of the subject that we deal with in Senate Bill 76. Nevertheless, it's the piece we have before us in this legislature. And I recognize and respect the feelings that it brought to this chamber today. I do urge your eye vote.
Those who have the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system.
Representative Esquivel, how do you vote? Esquivel votes no. Representative Call, how do you vote? Call votes aye. Senate Bill 76B, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 284, relating to civil actions.
The question now rises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 284B. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today we have a bill that's come to us in different forms almost every session for years. The whole idea of product liability, year after year we get brought the egregious cases to this body, and time after time we are asked to consider this ultimate repose on individual products and exempt that product so that they can actually have the lawsuit, because we all agree that what happened was truly egregious. And we talked about it last session when a group of teachers who sat in a gymnasium had their eyesight affected and their lives affected for the rest of their lives because of a faulty light bulb in their gymnasium. We took action and fixed that problem with respect to schools and other facilities around the state, but we still haven't solved the problem for those people. This bill, in one portion of it, takes care of that and allows them to pursue the case that they have against the person who made those light bulbs so that they can get the relief that I think everyone in this body agrees they deserve. But more than that, it starts to make some changes which I believe are appropriate. It changes from 8 years to 10 years, the ultimate repose statute in our state, and that means that for products built and produced in our state, we have one of the strictest liabilities in the country. 10 years will put us, most states are much higher than that. Ours will move from 8 to 10 years. It does not change at all the statute of limitations of when you have to apply, those kinds of things with respect to when you know you've been aggrieved. But it does one other rather elegant way of protecting our citizens against improper production in states outside of Oregon. One other state, Nebraska, made the same decision in 2001. And that is that it says if a product is produced in another state outside of Oregon, that we should use the statute of repose in that state. That producer works there, wants to be there, has already understood that repose in their state. It does not cause an aggrieved person in our state to have to go to that state to file a lawsuit. No, they can stay right here in Oregon, and they can have their day in court based on the other state's limit of repose. You'll have lots of questions about products coming in, and I know I have some questions, and I'll probably answer those there, about what about products that come into a particular port? How do we figure out what is that limit of repose? And I'll answer those questions as we get them, because I know I have them. But the short answer is we take possession in this country at the point of entry, and therefore where it enters generally would make sense to be the place where the limit of repose would be adjudicated at. So if it comes into Coos Bay, or if it comes into Portland, if it comes into Seattle, those are the places that we look at that statute of repose and say, here's where we go. When we go outside of that 10-year limit in Oregon, we go back to where did it come in what other state, just like we are with any of the other products produced in those states. And so, without going into a long explanation, fairly elegant bill that says change the statute of repose to 10 years for all products built in this state. Ask any other product built in another state to use whatever state they are producing it in to be the statute of repose. And make sure that we carve out an opportunity for those people who were hurt by the light bulbs, have the opportunity to have their day in court, which I think everybody has agreed to before. With that, I will stand ready to hopefully have all of you help support Senate Bill 284B.
Further discussion, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I think I'm supposed to start off with saying, honorable colleagues, we can argue about how long a manufacturer should remain responsible for its product after it's sold. Statutes of repose strike a balance between a consumer's right to redress for product defects and a manufacturer's reasonable responsibility for their products and the ability to defend themselves against defect accusations. Oregon's current law is very much in the mainstream, and when we're being presented with cases such as the light bulbs we heard about in Lake Oswego, we take action to fix these problems. Colleagues, I spent a lot of my hours last session working on the statute of repose, and we talked about, you know, we found a compromise on the situation in Lake Oswego. We even passed a bill. I happen to be in judiciary and education, and we passed a bill that told the school district's Department of Education, go out and fix these light bulbs immediately. We had to come back in the special session or the February session or whatever that session was and change it because there was no light bulbs manufacturer that would satisfy the need at that time. We took care. We addressed this issue. We spent a lot of hours in judiciary. And I would remind you, colleagues, this bill did not come through judiciary. It came through rules. The good carrier and a good friend talked about this bill and all the different things in the bill. I've got some comments here, but we're talking about implementing laws in other states and going out and finding which state it came into. I mean, that's... But what this bill does is implements a radical look-around approach. You have two letters from me on the floor today that I hope you've read and looked at this issue and who opposes this bill. There's a lot of people on this list that oppose it. But the look-around approach to product liability law that only one other state has adopted, and I think that state does not have political parties in their chamber. The Senate Bill 284 would delegate Oregon's legislative authority to other states by applying the statute of repose or lack thereof in the state of the original manufacturer in the case of foreign products, the state of importation. The importation provision would be unique in the United States, and even Nebraska does not have this provision. I have some other things to say. I'm sure you've made up your mind. Just remember, colleagues, I believe, and a lot of the people that signed here believe, that this is an anti-consumer, anti-business bill. But, colleagues, we continue to provide trial lawyer stimulus bills, and that's what this is, and you know it, and I know it. So vote your heart, and I urge it to be a no for the consumers and the businesses in Oregon who we continue this session to not help. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, the hour is late, and I will be brief. This is my second term dealing with statute of ultimate repose, and I don't think anybody argues when you hear testimony from these teachers who went to work one day, sat in a gymnasium, and came home blinded through no other action. It is incredibly compelling that you realize that product mistakes happen and they impact people and they ought to be able to sue over it. And the base bill, I certainly don't oppose allowing those teachers in Oregon to go forward with suits. The next piece of this bill is the Nebraska system. Nebraska is the only state that does this thing where wherever the thing was, whatever state manufactured the product or what port it came into the United States in, that's the statute of ultimate repose for that product. This is a very interesting idea. I did get some evidence that Nebraska thinks this works pretty well. Of course, they don't have a lot of ports in Nebraska, so that isn't an issue, which it is for us. So I was hanging kind of on the edge of this bill until we had a discussion about the fact that in the Senate doctors were opted out. Now, doctors don't manufacture anything, but they put things in people. And so they wanted to be opted out of this. And I said, okay, but then the hospitals came in, and you know, hospitals don't really manufacture anything either. And they wanted opted out specifically. And when we had a discussion on that happening, basically it was a big no, because there's some sense that hospitals in Oregon may at some point manufacture something. My friends, I don't know of any hospitals that are manufacturing things. It was a definite waffle. And what it told me was that we could see some significant lawsuits, medical lawsuits out of this, that would do nothing but raise the cost of health care and put our Oregon hospitals at a risk that I'm uncomfortable with. On balance, we have to deal with these certain teachers. There is no question that a harm has been done, and a bill has to go forward to help those teachers. This is not the bill, and I cannot support it. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I've been an attorney for 30 years, and in the course of that time have had the opportunity to represent individuals and families that have been injured through no fault of their own, and occasionally it would be because of a faulty product. A number of years ago, we had a family that were sitting in a pickup truck. Pickup truck had a gas tank inside the compartment right behind the seats. You remember those kinds of pickup trucks with the spout out the side. They're driving through an intersection about 40 miles an hour, just minding their own business, and a drunk driver came down the road, missed the stoplight, and crashed into the side of the pickup truck as it's going through this intersection. The momentum of the pickup truck caused it to reel to the side where the spout was at, continue to slide for another 150 feet before coming to a rest, and as it was sliding and coming to the rest, the sparks from the sliding pickup truck ignited the pouring fuel that was now on the pavement, and witnesses said that they watched as the pickup truck came to rest on the driver's door, and the passenger side, of course, had been impacted so it wouldn't open, and there was a mom and dad and three children inside this compartment as the fire caught up with the pickup truck, engulfed it in flames, and as innocent bypassers, you know, just witnesses, stood helpless to do anything, heard the suffering, the terror, and the final death of these five people. As it turns out, the pickup truck had been manufactured before the statute of limitations, or, you know, it was older than what we had in Oregon statute of limitations. If it had been a, you know, just shortly on the other side, there would have been a causable action for the design of this pickup truck. But since it was on the other side, there was no cause of action in Oregon. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no cause of action. It means that you then do what's called forum shopping. And so attorneys at that point, and our law firm was involved in this, searched the country to find a state where there would still be a cause of action for this family. And that state was Wisconsin. And so the action was brought in Wisconsin. The case was resolved in an amicable matter for between the manufacturer of the company and the survivors of this family, and it worked out. I mean, it was a tragedy beyond description, but the family that survived had to find a forum in Wisconsin. Now, we're talking about statute of ultimate repose here. Oregon presently has an 8-year statute, but if you get injured before the 8th year, it can be extended for 2 more years, so it can be 10 years. This proposed Senate bill merely makes it 10 years, but it adds to that 10 years the opportunity for consumers that may be injured through through no cause of their own, to have a cause of action in their home state, but based on the statute of limitation that exists where the product was manufactured. So this is a compromise bill that allows injured citizens to have a cause of action in their own state, but without expanding by very much the statute of limitation for Oregon manufacturers and Oregon citizens. It is a compromise bill. Having gone through that situation with that family and shared the grief of those that were left, it has never changed my heart. I want to do what's right for business, and I want to do what's right for consumers. I also want you to know, as a result of this, I went to the wrecking yard where this pickup truck was, and I was a new attorney, you know, pretty young, and I said, I need to have access to this pickup truck, but I can't afford to buy it from you. And so the owner of the wrecking yard said, I will put a tarp over it and I will protect it for you if you will promise that you will provide a fire extinguisher for every one of your family members, all of your cars and all of your staff's cars, because if these witnesses had had a fire extinguisher, they could have broken in and saved that family. To this day, we have fire extinguishers in all of my cars and the cars of my family. Thank you, and let's vote yes for this compromise bill. Thanks.
Further discussion, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier, does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
I would just like a little bit of clarification from what you first shared. If two otherwise identical products come to Oregon through ports of entry with different statutes of repose, would the different standards of law apply to product liability cases involving those products?
As I read the bill, and as I understand it, the answer is it would. And I would like to just answer that. When I first found that out, I rushed off to check and see if this was true, and the answer came back yes. And I said, so if my port of Coos Bay becomes a port of entry, and we're at 10 years, and California has none, and Washington has kind of a average life or whatever expectancy of the product, then my port becomes the port everybody wants to come through. And they indicated that might be true. Coos Bay might, because in fact we would have a 10-year limit on ours.
Okay. Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, the real appreciate the answer, and that is correct. It is yes. Two Oregon citizens hurt by otherwise identical defective products could have very different results for essentially the same problem. The so-called look-away provision in this bill violates the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Oregon Constitution because two purchasers of the same defective product could have arbitrarily different remedies if the product were either manufactured or distributed through distributors in different states. This is not good policy. And we should set one standard so that all Oregon citizens are treated equally under the law. That's a fundamental principle. Urge an aye vote, or correction, a no vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Vents.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, for many years when I first began the practice of law, I did products liability work. And in fact, even assisted in writing a law review article on it. Unfortunately, it's so many years ago, I can barely remember the area. I will say this, that this bill will have a cost because those manufacturers that do business here have to keep records longer. And it's always difficult to talk about business cost in light of the incredibly sad story we heard a few moments ago, but it's a trade-off, isn't it? If we wanted to always assist those who are so badly hurt, we would have no statute of ultimate repose. So the question becomes, is this extension going to create a burden for business greater than the good achieved by it? Having been through this and knowing the terrific cost, I will be a no vote, but it's a sad deal because you want to help everybody if you possibly can, but the cost here for the good done is too great, so I'll be a no vote.
Further discussion, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill, please. It would come to no surprise to anyone here that if anything happened to my family, I would call my friend here from East Clackamas, and I would ask him if it was a result of what I believed was a defective product. I would ask him, who's the best lawyer I can find? Because I'm going after him, and I want to get him, and I want to stick it to him. That's just in my nature. So, and I think that is my fundamental right as an American, and I do not ever question that or others. But I believe that so many times we get out of balance around here. It's incredible. A couple years ago we had a bill, and it said, well, the state of Washington passed this, and they said it'd take effect when we did it. And here we are saying, well, we're going to base our laws based on all these other states' laws. That just doesn't sound right to me. It just sounds instinctively wrong. But last session we could have had an ultimate repose deal, and the good people promoting it wanted to go further. Here I think we're creating an environment where we will have far greater and far more, thank you, counselor, litigious community, and I don't, because people will be searching around every state, well, where can I stick it to them the most? Now, nothing can bring a family, lost family member back. All the money in the world wouldn't. But I just think we're out of balance. I think we're creating an environment that could cause far more litigation when we could solve the problem right here and save a lot of people a lot of time, pain, and money. I urge your no vote.
Further discussion? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. A question for the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. As a product that is assembled in Oregon, but using parts from Washington or New York, then how long would the statute of repose be for that product?
I thank you for the question, and thanks for getting to me ahead of time. As I understand it, component parts could have a different repose if they, in fact, were the product that was made in a way that was defective and it caused the problem. So if a product was compiled here and parts of it were from other places, we could use the reach out and find another place. But I guess what I would tell you is that, you know, it's still the plaintiff has to prove that it was defective. I mean, this doesn't automatically happen. This is about a defective product, something that either they knew or should have known should have been corrected and not produced that way. So, yes, products built here using component parts, they could look at that component part, if that's the defective part, and go and reach outside, as I understand it.
Thank you. Madam Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Yes, the answer to that question is that there is no time limit. Under this bill, an Oregon manufacturer could face liability for a product that made the Model T when it was the newest car on the market. If one part of a product assembled in Oregon comes from a state or a port of entry where there is no statute of repose, then an Oregon manufacturer would face virtual unlimited liability. In fact, one Oregon manufacturer has a case in Louisiana today which has no limit for a product that was built in 1923. That's absurd. We should do everything we can to attract manufacturing business to this state. In fact, colleagues, we have a pretty decent manufacturing business. And if you listen to the revenue forecast for the state of Oregon, we manufacture a lot of products that people will put off during a depression or during a recession. Sorry for the slip, because truly it feels like a depression in this state. We have manufacturers that manufacture things that go all over the place. And we are going to expose the liability for those businesses to a greater degree by passing this bill today. Colleagues, this is the session where we should be doing things to support business, yes, and protecting those we represent, the consumers. But heck, they're not going to have any money to buy any of these products because they don't have jobs. And all we do is keep passing bills on this floor that if you are a business looking to do business in a global competitive environment, taxes, liability, employer, rules and laws, we just say, as my good colleague would say, we don't want you here. I urge your no vote.
Any further discussion? Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want to talk for a moment about cost and balance, two words that we've heard this morning about this bill. The opponents warn us of increased uncertainty and liability, which will raise the costs of manufacture. Those costs, as the representative notes, will probably be passed on to consumers. And I don't dispute that any of those things are true. My colleague from Wilsonville points out from time to time when we pass insurance mandates, each mandate we pass causes the price of insurance premiums to go up by a little bit, and I don't think any serious person denies that that's also true. The problem I see with the argument the opponents have made this morning is that it ignores the cost of the status quo. Every time a dangerous product is manufactured, released into the stream of commerce, and injures someone, that comes at a social cost. If you aren't sure about that, please read the 4-letter on your desk from the school teachers in my district, already referenced by several members here this morning, who were injured by a defective halide light that exposed them to 41 days worth of continuous radiation in the course of 5 hours and 20 minutes. Medical costs, lost productivity of 4 school teachers, permanent pain and vision impairment. Those are all costs. Some easy to quantify, some less easy to quantify, but they are all costs. So the real question posed by this bill is not whether or not we will have cost. That's a false question, because that question is answered every time a dangerous product hurts somebody. The real question posed by this bill is who will pay? Under current law, Oregonians who are injured one day after the expiration of an arbitrary deadline have no remedy. That doesn't mean there is no cost. It just means they bear those costs by themselves. Passage of this bill will therefore not create new costs. It will redistribute costs that are already there. Another principle that I agree with my colleague from Wilsonville on, and I know this because we've discussed it in the context of land use, is that the benefits and burdens of a policy should be distributed fairly, justly, and equitably. Current law places all of the burden of a defective product on the innocent victim and none of it on the negligent manufacturer. That's not fair, that's not just, it's not equitable, and that's why I support this bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Roblin, do you wish to close?
Yes, thank you, Madam Speaker. We've had a lot of discussion today about this fairly simple bill that does a lot with respect to consumers in our state. And I want to start out by saying that my first real introduction to this was that I was the proud owner as a newly married, having our first child person in the state of Washington at the time, who owned a Pinto. And as many people may remember, Pintos had a problem about rear-end collisions and blowing up. And the evidence that came out in the trial showed that they actually kind of knew that at the company when they built it, but they had analyzed how many suits it would be and so on and so forth and came to the conclusion that it was too hard to change it, and so they let that happen. And I happened to be in a very icy road conditions, heavy snow in Renton, Washington, parked at a stoplight as I looked in my rearview mirror and realized that the car that was coming was not going to stop. And the ruts that I were in were the same ruts he was in. And so told my family to prepare to get hit. And we got rear-ended in our Pinto, and nothing happened, which was really nice, and I really appreciate it. But I will tell you that it is a frightening experience to know that you're in a product that has been proven to have a built-in problem that results in the opportunity for your family and yourself to die. As the good representative from, let's see, make sure I get these all right. Is it Southern Oregon? Spoke to us earlier. We now put our consumers, Oregonians, in the place that they have to figure out. They've already been in a tragic accident. Their attorney is finding out what other states may have a repose. We saw a young man here who had his arms removed in a harvester earlier this year. He had to go to a different state. So you're already in a problem. Now you have to raise money to go to another state to do a lawsuit, which with this bill passing, they could do right here at home. And as they said before, the results happened in the other places. We had a question from the good representative from Salem, Almsville, and Turner that said, what about those people who are building things here and have a product, they import a product from another state and they put it into it, they're going to get sued. Well, the reality is, if the product liability is against the component, it'll be this country that, the company that made the component, not the company that put it together. That's who they're going to go after, because that's the one that was put in. And I would hope that our company would be the company that here that bought that product in good faith, believing it was built correctly, would have a cause of action against that company for having sold them the product that they put into their product. Because the reality is, none of us want to knowingly sell, make, or produce products which cause harm to people, because not from anything that they did. So I urge you to think about this and think about the opportunity that it will give Oregon consumers to go after what I believe they rightly deserve, because they were injured through no fault of their own and with a product that was built in such a way as that it helped cause that injury. I urge your support.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill will pass should vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system.
Representative Bruin, how do you vote? Bruin votes aye. Senate Bill 284B, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Other business of the House, other business of the Senate, orders that they have been completed, announcements. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Democrats will not have a caucus today. We will caucus on Monday. Have a safe weekend.
Representative Hanna.
Safe weekend.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Republicans, we will not caucus today. We will caucus at 9 a.m. Monday. Please have a nice weekend.
Any further announcements? Remonstrances. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Speaker, I request permission to return to the order of propositions and motions so the super minority leader can make a pointless motion.
Representative Nolan objects. Very nice, Representative Cameron. Further remonstrances. We should point out, for those who don't know it, that the main author of the script, including the phrase super minority, is the chief of staff in the super minority office. So any further remonstrances? Representative Jensen, adjournment 9:45 Monday.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 9:45 a.m., Monday, June 15, 2009.
Representative Jensen moves that the House adjourn until 9:45 a.m. on Monday, June 15, 2009. Without objection, have a great weekend. House adjourned.